on judiciary. We have a little bit of measure introduction business we're going to do right off the bat, and then we're going to go to an informational meeting with Jeff Tryons, who's the executive director of the Oregon Progress Board, on some benchmark issues. And then we've got three bills that we'll address. So that'll be our agenda for the day. So in front of you, there should be several LC drafts. We'll start with LC 1291. Council, you want to tell us what this does?
LC 1291.
LC 1291 requires entry of a judgment with installment payments in certain actions in which $100,000 or more is awarded for losses that will be incurred by plaintiff after entry of judgment. Provides that a court may require that installments be paid through the trust fund annuity or through another form of security.
And this bill is at the request of the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. LC 1374.
LC 1374 authorizes assignment of judgments from Justice Court to the Department of Revenue for collection.
And LC 1588.
LC 1588 removes prohibition on justice of the peace district, including portions of the city that is the county seat or in which the circuit court regularly holds court, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage.
And LC 1588-1.
The dash one version of 1588. Adds that the transfers and payments of money cannot be made later than the last day of the month following the month in which the money is to be collected. Also declares an emergency in effect upon passage.
And LC 1374, 1588, and 1588-1 are all at the request of the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. LC 1957, I'm not going to introduce today, in part because I don't have who it's at the request of. And I recall generally the bill, but I don't remember who requested it, so we'll do that later. It's LC 1957. Is that not in your stack? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, then there's another good reason not to do it.
That was one you and I talked about. Remember?
It was okay. That's where
it
came
from. Come up later.
Yeah, that's okay. Why don't we go ahead and we'll put it on for tomorrow when we can distribute a copy of the draft to all the committee members. But we'll go ahead and do that in tomorrow's. Shows you how quickly my memory is failing me. Representative Ackerman, I apologize.
No problem.
Okay, so the chair would move the introduction of LC 1291, 1374, 1588, and 1588-1 as bills to be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bills will be introduced as committee bills, and the standard disclaimer that the introduction of the bill neither indicates support or opposition by any member of the committee as the bill moves forward through the process. And we'll go ahead and distribute copies of the LC draft of LC 1957 for introduction at tomorrow's meeting. With that, colleagues, we will move on to the next order of business, which is an informational presentation by Jeff Tryons, the Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. Welcome, Jeff.
Happy to be here, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Jeff Tryons. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. What I'd like to do today in about 20 minutes or half an hour is to review for the new members very quickly just what the Progress Board is, and then spend some time on where we are on a number of the indicators that the Progress Board tracks that relate to the work of this particular House committee. I apologize for the color pattern if you're having a problem reading it. I'm not a Miami fan. It's not that I just have to have Dolphins colors in there in order to be happy. I had to switch out my laptop at the last minute, and the new one has changed the colors around a bit. So just in case anyone was wondering. The Oregon Progress Board was created in statute in 1989. It is the strategic planning entity for the state of Oregon, not just Oregon state government, but for the state as a whole. The chair of the board is the governor. The progress board is made up of 13 Oregon leaders chosen and appointed by the governor. It was revisited in statute in 1997 and made a permanent part of state government at that time. The board has a strategic vision, they call it, called Oregon Shines, which is updated every 8 years. And then these measures of how Oregon is doing and carrying out that vision, which are called the benchmarks. And that's what I will do this afternoon, is share with you some of where we are on the benchmarks that relate to your work. When this was created, Oregon was really the first state that had tried to create a set of measures about results, about what it was we were accomplishing as a state, not how hard we were trying, but what it was we were actually accomplishing that linked to the vision that we had for Oregon. So, for instance, the Progress Board measures things like literacy rates, crime rates, air and water quality. We don't measure for the benchmarks, not that these aren't important, but we don't measure school expenditures. We don't measure beds that we have in prisons. We don't measure how hard we're trying, in other words, or how much money we're spending, but what it is we're actually accomplishing. And that's the idea behind the benchmarks. Each of the benchmarks has a very clearly stated measure of what it is we are measuring in order to know how well we're doing. And there is a handout for anybody who wants to follow this in hard copy. We also have to have the data. Now, that may seem obvious, but in the early days of the benchmarks, many, many advocates for certain issues wanted Oregon to have one of the benchmarks be on their issue, but there was no data. So when I came in 1995, we had 259 listed measures, and for about 80 of them, 6 years into the process, we still didn't have the data. So now the rule is we can only have 100 or less, and that was what one of the things that we heard the last time we reviewed this with legislative involvement. And in order to have a measure, it actually has to have some numbers attached to it. The Progress Board sets targets for where we want to be in the future. So, for instance, what you see here is that we had an OO number where we wanted to be, and we had a 10 number where the board felt like Oregon needed to be, and we have that for almost all of the measures, and that's one of the things you'll see on the slides that I will be sharing with you. Benchmarks are reviewed every 2 years. It's done in a public process. We have individual Oregonians who come and say we need a new measure on. We have agencies who come and say, we think you ought to change this measure because it's really not measuring exactly what it is we think you want. The board uses input from experts as well as advocates in terms of the targets, and the targets were changed pretty dramatically back in 1997 to move from being what I would call aspirational, which is we want everything to be wonderful, to being what we call ambitious but realistic. In other words, if we are able to exert ourselves as a state, we ought to be able to get there. The issues we'll look at with you this afternoon are issues relating to crime, issues relating to incarceration, emergency management, and then the last one is the issue of child support enforcement. So does anybody have any questions? Is that all clear about sort of who we are and why we're here? Okay. This is the most complicated slide I have, so excuse me for starting out with one that may be a little hard for you to read. This looks at the overall reported crime rate, which is one of the benchmarks we have, and then we split it out to crimes against people, crimes against property, and behavior crimes. So what you can see here is that Oregon has continued through 01, and we have no information on 02. And as for those of you who saw the LEDS announcement the other day, the Law Enforcement Data Systems announcement, that they were essentially closing up shop, we may not have 02 numbers statewide for some time. So what we have to work with right now is 01. And we saw through the end of 01 a continuing fall in the crime rate in Oregon. This is reported crime. This is not arrest. And what I have here, this orange line is the long-term trend line. So we get the computer to lay out the trend for us. So it's just strictly what the numbers show. And you can see Oregon's, in spite of having a couple of quite high years in 95 and 97, Oregon's overall crime rate in the 90s went down a bit. Now, let me look at each of these specific areas. Crimes against persons, which is obviously the most serious crimes we have, these are assaults, murders, etc., has continued to go down and saw a substantial reduction in 01, where we saw the rest of the crime rate kind of flatten out a little bit. This one has continued to fall steadily since 1995. Property crimes, which are more sensitive to the economy, that is, as the economy starts to go bad, you often see these crimes increasing some, as you can see, went up a bit in 01. So we'd seen a steady reduction from 97, 98, 99, 00, and then we went up just a little bit in 01. And then behavior crimes, which is kind of a grab basket of all kinds of crimes. It's the other category, if you will. Also went down in 01 from 00 and also had that steady slight reduction that we saw in the other rates, that trend, as you can see, is increasing just a little bit over time. But in none of these areas have we seen anything but pretty good news for some time. You'll notice up in the middle part, right at the right over the graph, it says, "Are we making progress?" And that's just a question of how the trend line is headed in each of these areas. One of the things we like to do is look at how Oregon compares to others. Both the U.S. average and Washington is what we usually look at. We've asked Oregonians many times what they're most comfortable comparing themselves to, and it's only Washington. There is no other state that really Oregonians feel like they can go, well, yeah, we're a lot like that state. And it's the U.S. average is okay, but really not as meaningful to most people as how we compare with Washington. Most Oregonians don't realize that Washington is twice as large as Oregon either, but in terms of population, but that is the state that we feel most alike. So this compares Oregon with both Washington and the nation in terms of overall arrests. Now, the national statistics are on arrest rates. So not the same as reported crime, but similar, if you will. You can see that Oregon ranks in the 40s, with number one being the lowest arrest rate of any state, and has ranked in the 40s for a long time. Washington was lower than Oregon and has surpassed Oregon in the last number of years. Washington, the last times these statistics were available, was 45th in the nation, the 45th highest arrest rate in the nation. Most people would not realize that Oregon had such a high ranking in terms of its arrest rate. It always comes as a surprise to me when I go and look at these statistics and go, I can't be right. I live here. I've lived on the East Coast. I know how people feel, but it's true. We have one of the highest arrest rates in the country. So while we've been making progress ourselves with reported crime falling, we have also seen in relation with the U.S., we've actually increased a little bit because crime has fallen in all the other states as well. If anybody has any questions, please just stop me and ask.
Representative Krimmel, you open the door, Jeff. Representative Krimmel.
I'm just wanting to make sure that I understand what this says. It says national crime rank, all offenses first equals best.
Right.
So if you're number one in the country, then your arrest rate is real low.
It's real low. That's
okay.
Exactly right.
Thank you.
Right. Right. We always try to have, no matter what the benchmark is, we always try to have number one be best. So that is the lowest rate. If you look at Oregon's, if you look at just at the arrests per 100,000, you see that Oregon runs about 25% higher than the U.S. So we rank high, and ranking can sometimes be misleading because you can rank high and be that, you know, you can be the 45th and be that close to 23rd, you know, because the ranking is just very tight. So you have to look at the absolute numbers as well. But having a 25% higher rate than the U.S. is pretty substantial.
Yes, Representative Sands.
Looking at that, I mean, does that really tell us? What does that really tell us? I mean, what's that? I mean, looking at that slide, it says that Oregon ranks about 25% higher in, on the average for arrest. Does that mean that we have a higher percentage of reporting of crime? We have a more efficient law enforcement agencies that are actually making arrests as compared to crime maybe not being reported?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, it could be any of those things. I have yet to go to a county where I make a presentation on the crime rate and the sheriff is in the room where the sheriff does not say, that's because we have a user-friendly sheriff's department and lots of, and in our county people aren't afraid to report crime because they know something will be done about it. Now, I'm not sure that can be true in every county, but there are lots of variables under an arrest number. That's why I have arrests rather than reported crime. I'd rather have reported crime because people are more likely to report crimes in a uniform way than we are to arrest people in a uniform way.
But looking at this, Mr. Chair, if I can,
yeah,
as an isolated slide, I mean, the other ones that you brought forward show that we've had these declines trending, showing that actually our crime rate for property as well as for person is on a decline.
Yes, that's right. But it so happens that's true for the rest of the United States as well. So while we're going down, the U.S. average is going down as well. So we're staying higher than the U.S. average at about the same amount rather than making any ground on the U.S. average. And I wish the FBI had reported crime, but they don't. So we try to give you something to compare to, you know, kind of outside of Oregon. And in this area, it so happens that the best thing that we have is the arrest rates.
I'll just point out, too, for the committee that I have just not long ago, about the last year or so, have served on the Progress Board. And we spent an inordinate amount of time appropriately talking about what comparatives to look at and what you can actually rely on in data. And Jeff spends an amazing amount of time looking at data sets to determine whether or not the data set means anything. And that is one of the challenges when you're doing any of this kind of work. To the extent that on arrests there is so much discretion and variability state to state, but to the extent it's the only thing that's nationally reported, it's really the only thing you can run a comparison.
And when you're looking at something as large as every other state, a lot of those things kind of wash out. Unless we had some reason to argue that Oregon was extraordinary in some area that had to do with the relationship between crime being reported and arrests being made, it's not going to be that far off. But you're exactly right that it is a, you know, it's one of those things that's hard to know exactly what it means. In Oregon, the benchmark that we use for juvenile crime is actually juvenile arrest, because when a crime is reported, there's no way of knowing what the age of the individual was who was involved in that crime in general. There are certain crimes that you would probably know were, you know, youth related, but we don't know that. So we report the arrest rate, and it looks very much like the overall reported crime rate, which, as you can see, the peak that we had in 94, 95, 96, which is during the time that the legislature was enacting and reforming the way we handled juvenile crime in Oregon. It was at its highest. Those arrest rates were some of the highest we'd had in a long, long time. And we've seen that number fall every year since then. So in spite of those high years, we still have a downward trend in terms of the arrest rate for crimes that are involving a young person. So we'll look at each of these again for just a minute. Once again, the person crimes looks just like the overall reported crime rate. It's going down steadily every year. We are, as you'll note, already under the target that the Progress Board established a couple of years ago, 405. So we're doing much better in arrests. And once again, this is resource sensitive, but the Progress Board has in fact removed behavior crimes from this measure because that's the one that's most resource sensitive. You're not going to not arrest for an assault. So we think this is still a pretty good measure of criminal activity among young people in Oregon, and we've seen that number, as I said, fall every year since 1993, really. The arrest for crimes against property, interestingly enough, even though it's up statewide, reported crime is up, property arrest for juveniles continues to fall. So it has fallen steadily, like the person crimes. Oregon, and here's some positive news in terms of national comparators. Oregon is actually substantially under both Washington and U.S. and the U.S. when it comes to what the Department of Justice calls their violent crime index, which is again arrests. But if you look at the numbers, Oregon has about 200 arrests per 100,000, whereas both the U.S. and Washington are up around 325. So we are substantially under the U.S. average and under the Washington average when it comes to the most serious crimes involving young people. We also have seen a pretty significant reduction, and we only go out to get these numbers every 2 years, in the self-reported carrying of weapons among students. So more positive news that number also has been falling since the mid-1990s. So I'm going to change gears here and look at recidivism. In summary, I would say that we see that in every category, essentially, of crime that we track, that we're making progress, that things we're still higher than the U.S. with overall, as I said, but we are seeing reductions in all of the areas that we've looked at and that we will look at. One of the other measures we have is the percentage of paroled offenders who are convicted of a new felony within 3 years. That number has also fallen during the period that we've tracked it from 1990 through 2002. We have those numbers through 2002. There's a slow but steady reduction in that reoffense rate.
Yes, Representative Barker.
Mr. Chairman, on those, I see about the time Measure 11 kicked in, so people are in longer, not getting where they used to be out reoffending quite mm-hmm. frequently. Mm-hmm. Do you think that is added to this at all, to Measure 11? Mandatory sentencing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, this is not my area of expertise, but I have heard enough times people make the argument that, yes, Measure 11 is the reason for this, and other people going, no, Measure 11 isn't the reason for this, because if you look at other states, you can see this kind of trend. I think from my own, and I'm really a layperson when it comes to this question, but I think that it certainly did not... it certainly had an impact. The amount of that impact, I think, is really the question we have, whether it was largely responsible or just one of a number of factors.
Okay, thank you.
No one's going to jump on me for that. I try never to talk about the effect of Measure 11 in public.
Representative Gibson, you move your microphone. I take that as a signal.
Thank you, sir. Yes. I'm thinking that if one put national data together on this and used Measure 11 in Oregon, you could get a statistical probability of whether this Measure 11 did or did not have an impact. Wasn't anything of that nature attempted or tried?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the Progress Board has not tried that, but my understanding is that has been done.
Thank you, Mr. Tryons. Representative Jensen, several years ago, the RAND Corporation began a longitudinal study of the impacts of Ballot Measure 11. They released a preliminary draft report for comment from the various stakeholder groups at an interim Judiciary Committee meeting that was held in conjunction with a site visit to a Deschutes County program over the summer. They are in the process of taking comments, I think, from the stakeholder group and finalizing their report. Mr. Taylor, if he were here, could probably tell us the date that that's going to be finally available for review. But there will be this RAND report, which was to look at the impacts of Measure 11, and how conclusive it's going to be in answering the question that you posed, I think, is going to be one of the questions. As Mr. Tryons pointed out, if you spend any time looking at the national crime statistics, you will see that there has been a general downward trend in crime during the mid to late 90s. And it is a bit befuddling to look at states that passed strict measures like three strikes you're out, like ballot measure 11 and other determinate sentencing sort of approaches, and compare them to states that didn't pass those measures, and to see in some cases almost the same percentage rate of reduction in crime. And so it does somewhat befuddle you as you look at what you think instinctively ought to have made an impact, and I still think you must take the position that to some degree it has made an impact, but then how do you measure that? And I'm hopeful that the final version of this RAND report will give us some tools to maybe answer some of those questions and maybe ask some new ones that we need to potentially talk about as we move forward.
If I might just add, and I know that you know this, Representative Jensen, but the maddening problem with statistical analysis is even when it's very clean and very clear, all it shows is correlations. It still doesn't show cause and effect. So you have to ask the question, is there some measurable relation between these two things? But there's still no way to know for sure that that's what the cause was. A new measure that we have, which has been requested for some time from various parties, is a recidivism number for young people who are in the OIA system. So we've been able to measure that. They were able to measure that back to 1994. The Progress Board just adopted this measure this time. And interestingly, although the definition of reoffend is not the same thing as it is for adults, we still see between 35% to 40% of all of the people in the system reoffend on this new standard, which is, do they have a new criminal referral within 12 months after having been released? We see a slight positive trend here, not increasing, but a slight reduction in the rate of reoffending. I apologize for the readability of this particular slide. I was in here madly changing the colors when the machine wouldn't report them in the right way, and it won't let me into the slide for some reason. So, my apologies. The progress board does measure some things that relate to process. I said at the beginning that we're only about results, and that's the tagline, but the truth is there are some processes that the board also tracks because they're viewed as particularly important. One of the things that the state police asked the progress board for a long time ago was for it to measure the percentage of counties that had cooperative policing agreements in place. So the board continues to measure that. As you can see, in the mid-1990s, we were making substantial progress in terms of moving up to 100% of all counties. Since 1999, we've only added one county a year, essentially. So at 80%, we've got about seven counties that are still not on board. I don't have that list for you, but if you like them, I would be happy to find that. But most of the counties in Oregon, and these aren't weighted by the population, so this is just 36 counties. How many of them have these agreements in place? I would assume that this has taken on new importance in Oregon and the rest of the country in light of the Homeland Security Act, et cetera, but anyway, that's where we are. We've also modified the measure in terms of emergency preparedness. This also is one of the benchmarks that's tracked by now the Office of Emergency Management. It has been for a long time State Police, and we've modified it to put it into two parts, which is the percentage of counties and communities. And that is a select set that are prepared for emergencies with hazard information and are undertaking risk reduction activities. And two, the percentage of counties that are prepared to respond and recover from emergencies. As you can see, most of Oregon's counties in 1999 were viewed by the state police at that time as being prepared to respond to emergencies. They have to recertify every 5 years, and when the counties recertified in 00 to a new higher standard, a whole lot of those counties were no longer certified at that higher standard. So we're moving back up. We're at about 80% of counties now that are at that higher standard. In terms of having risk reduction in place and having the information about hazards, we only have about 40% of all of Oregon counties that are certified by the office, by the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries as having the necessary information when it relates to natural disaster emergencies. The last one I want to show you in terms of the benchmark is child support enforcement. Oregon tracks this because it's such an important social support for those children who have absent parents. And as you can see, Oregon has been pretty flat at 60% of all of the enforcement orders in place actually being, with the money being made available to the children. And that number has really stayed the same since 1994. When you compare Oregon with the rest of the country, you see that Oregon is 28th in this area, whereas Washington is 8th. So I know the department is working very hard on this, but it is an issue where we are significantly lower than a lot of other states in terms of the legal right to have the child support enforcement and the actual instances where the money is being paid.
Jeff, I want to ask you
yes.
about that. When you most of the child support enforcement issues are now federally mandated,
mm-hmm.
federal law that sort of that we've been spending a good part of this committee's time over the last 4 years sort of making sure that our state laws are in compliance with the federal,
right.
It's tied to federal funding and all sorts of other issues. Do you have any information or data or experience based on the Progress Board's investigation on this particular statistic as to why Washington would be, you know, 20 places higher on the list, and recognizing again that that might be a difference of, you know, small increments,
right.
Is it that kind of an issue? I mean, what would be making it harder since the legal right is essentially going to be the same in almost
right.
every state?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. There's a very good website that has all of this information on it, and I would be happy to have a look at that and come back and answer the question in terms of what the gap is, if it's a substantial gap or a small gap. I would be either happy to, you know, I mean, I think we'd be happy to do some investigation on that. It may be that the department already knows. DOJ, you know, has a child support enforcement unit.
Right, and they spend a lot of time in front of this committee, so this is a sort of a surprising statistic given what I consider to be sort of our front-edge approach to
right.
not wasting any time and making sure that they've got the tools that they need.
Well, it's a surprising one to me as well, since the numbers, I mean, not only is the ranking low, but the numbers are incorrect, and they're not incorrect. We actually had to change this because the calculation was not being done quite the right way, and we dropped from having reported 70% of all cases to 60% because of a math error that was made in the numbers that were reported to us. But I would have, if I was in your seat, I would want to know why these numbers have been flat for the last 5 years. And I would be happy to find out what I can in terms of what happened with the 28th ranking. We had a ranking up here the last time I was here, and Oregon was 18th and Washington was 11th. But I couldn't be sure that it was apples to apples when we got this new number, so I didn't include it on the slide. But I think it's an area of inquiry. There may be perfectly clear and legitimate answers for why.
Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, my question and perhaps a suggestion is whether your review breaks down the states between those which have and those which do not have mandatory child support guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
My argument being that perhaps states with mandatory guidelines would have an average higher child support judgment than those which are left, if that decision is left solely to the court. And maybe that may explain the difference between Washington and Oregon. I don't really know. But our child support guidelines, you know, are fairly strict, and
mm-hmm.
The court doesn't have a lot of leeway.
We spent a lot of time with Ronell Schenkel, who is the person that is sort of the legislative liaison of this
mm-hmm.
committee on that issue. So you might, if you would, Jeff, just give her a call and
mm-hmm.
chat with her about those issues. And at some point, either she or you could maybe get back to the committee on that. I think it's an interesting question. Representative Jensen.
Just quickly, I wonder if you'd also share with us the website that you were referring to.
Mr. Chair, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I would be happy to get back to you with it, yes. It's very good. It's a very good site.
Thanks, Jeff.
And I would add that I met with the child support enforcement whole team last spring when they were working on their agency performance measures, and this was, you know, we help agencies lay out logic models, which is okay. What are you measuring? What's your strategy to get there? And they're really quite focused on this. So I just don't have the answers right now. I want to talk just for a minute about what we are doing in terms of measurement and linking in with agencies in terms of performance measurement, performance management. The Progress Board, as a result of House Bill 3358 that was enacted in 2001, was required to establish the guidelines for all agencies they had to follow in terms of linking up with the benchmarks in terms of what their own work was going to be and what their own results were going to be. We have been, not only did the Progress Board write the guidelines, but we ended up doing all the training and most of the work, working with agencies, assisting them in putting their measures in place. And we've got most of the agencies ready to go. We still have a few that we are working on, but I think for those of you who are involved in the budget process in Oregon will be pleasantly surprised at how easy it is to see what agencies are planning with the money that we are appropriating for achieving results, not how hard they try, but what it is they're actually accomplishing and how that links up with the benchmarks. I just want to do one last thing, Mr. Chair, which is we just wrapped up the Oregon population survey 2 weeks ago. You may have seen an article about it in the Oregonian. There was an article in the Statesman. I think it was on the Wire as well, where the Progress Board and 17 other state agencies do a single state survey every 2 years to meet the needs that agencies have to find out what's going on with the population. And one of the things that we ask Oregonians is how well they think Oregon is doing in providing a whole series of services. So this chart, which you have, ranks how well Oregonians think the state, and we just say Oregon, we don't say the Parks Department, the state police, we just say Oregon, in a whole series of areas. You'll see all the way over there on the right is if 100% said that Oregon was doing a somewhat good or a good job, that would be that they'd get 100. So as you can see, the top ranked service in Oregon is Parks and Recreation. The lowest rank, no surprise, is job creation, which fell like a stone between 00 and 02. And you'll see that crime control, interestingly enough, was up at over 80% of all Oregonians thought Oregon was doing a pretty good job in that area. Now, maybe that reflects the fact that we see the statistics with crime falling, and people do have a sense that we're doing pretty well with crime. The other area of interest to you, perhaps, is in terms of drug use. that has always been the lowest ranking that we've had, and it's just a measure of how lousy this recession is that it's now been surpassed by the ability to create jobs in Oregon as the lowest ranked of all the things we do. If you look at the biggest change between 1994 and 2002, same services listed on the left-hand side, you'll see that controlling crime is by far the most improved ranking in Oregon. It's gone up 41 percentage points between 1994 and 02. And also the second most improved is the one that sort of relates to crime, which is controlling the use of drugs. So I thought those were very interesting. And between 00 and 02, you can see that crime control was just a little bit under controlling sprawl, which also was a little bit of a surprise to me. So Oregonians see these changes in crime, I think, and they are viewing it as an area where we've had substantial improvement. And for anybody who wants it, these are just all the data that we have for each of those areas of service. That's the end of my remarks, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to take any other questions. I have about three things written down here that I need to get back to you on. And
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you equating controlling growth with controlling sprawl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, not at all.
Okay, because I don't see controlling sprawl on the list here.
No, it's the one that says controlling growth. It says controlling, it's right in the middle. Controlling growth and urban sprawl is the whole sentence. Right, if I get my arrow going here. Right there, that's controlling growth.
Where's your arrow at?
Right in the middle of the page. Right.
Oh, there it is, okay.
And the one down here is drug use.
Okay, the reason why I'm asking is because controlling growth and controlling sprawl are really two different things.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell.
Controlling sprawl, we actually do a pretty good job. Controlling growth, actually it should be more like managing growth, and we probably don't do so hot at that.
Well, they ask a series of questions, and it may in fact be managing growth and urban sprawl now that I think about it. But that's one of the questions we ask. It doesn't have anything to do with drugs at all. If it sounded like I was equating them somehow, I wasn't at all.
No, I was trying to equate controlling growth and controlling sprawl, and they're not the same.
Right. I think we probably ask, and I will. We probably ask managing growth and control and urban sprawl. So managing growth and urban sprawl is probably the way the words are actually
Jeff,
said.
Jeff, would you be able to perhaps deliver the sort of executive summary portion of the population survey to the committee members?
I will be happy. It's actually right here. I have the language right there. Managing growth and preventing sprawl.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Treance, does the Progress Board measure the incarceration rate in Oregon as compared to other states? That is, the percentage of our population that at any one time is incarcerated.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that is not one of the benchmarks. I'm sure the data is out there, and I'd be happy to find it for you. But that's not one of the Oregon benchmarks.
Representative McPherson, the Department of Corrections actually has that data and would be able to show us a comparator as a percentage of population, the number of incarcerated in Oregon as compared to other states.
Mr. Chair, that would be I think helpful information for those of us who are new to this process.
Yeah, and I don't see anybody from DOC in the room, so Bill, would you write that down as a request that we should make of DOC? Any other questions for Mr. Treance? I just tell you, colleagues, that my short stint on the Progress Board has convinced me that they're working with the agencies in developing agency performance measures as linked to the benchmarks is a format and a footprint and a path to a performance-based budgeting model that already exists and is available to us and is already working. And as we start to look at some of these budgeting model issues as we move through this legislative session, I'd highly encourage you to spend some time understanding how the Progress Board has worked with agencies and starting to direct them to the benchmark process through their own agency performance measures. It's frankly an exciting way to approach this, and it ought to prevent us from spending a lot of time recreating the wheel. There's my small comment editorially made. With that, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. We're going to move on to our next order of business, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2098. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2098 was introduced at the request of the Attorney General for the Department of Justice. House Bill 2098 prohibits a nonprofit organization from using an Oregon address in conjunction with a charitable solicitation unless the nonprofit actually maintains an Oregon office or states in the solicitation that the headquarters of the nonprofit is not in Oregon and the Oregon address is simply a mail drop.
Great.
I understand that we do have some witnesses on this bill. One.
I sort of figured it was Mr. Laybourne. Ross, if you want to come forward, that would be great. And also, could we get the overhead lights now?
Here.
Great. Thanks, Jeff.
You have the money. You have the money?
Yeah.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Ross Laybourne. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I serve as attorney in charge of the Department of Justice's Charitable Activities Section. One of our main missions is combating charitable solicitations fraud in the state of Oregon, and the principal way we do that is to enforce Oregon's Charitable Solicitations Act, which can be found at in Chapter 128. I'm here today to encourage the passage of House Bill 2098. It would basically do two things, one substantive and one by way of remedies. Both relate principally to solicitations being conducted by out-of-state charities and out-of-state professional fundraisers who are soliciting our citizens. The request and receipt of contributions in this state as well as around the country is a major activity. Just to give you a sense of that, we have registered with us over 12,000 charitable organizations. They file annual reports. When you total up those reports, and here we're talking about non-religious charitable organizations, it's direct contributions from our citizens, our businesses, our foundations, total over $1 billion a year. Even in tough times, our citizens are very generous. And there are certainly many worthy national and international causes to give to, but we also, as you know, have tremendous needs at home. And what we've discovered is that many of our citizens would prepare to give a substantial portion of their contributions to aid other citizens in our community. Out-of-state fundraisers know that, as do some out-of-state charities with marginal charitable programs. And so consequently, we have seen over the past few years this phenomenon of these out-of-state organizations setting up mail drops for the receipt of return contributions in the state of Oregon, when in fact these private mailboxes are set up, as near as we can tell, for no other purpose than to collect that money for that private person to be paid to then forward those envelopes to some out-of-state collection point. We believe that donors in this state should consider both local and national, international causes, but at the end of the day, that there should be informed giving and they should have the opportunity to decide what are the major factors in their own minds in terms of how they want to give their dollars. And we believe that some of this activity of setting up these private mailboxes is simply to deceive the donors. Sometimes, of course, in the course of the solicitation process, there are just plain lies. Last year, we brought an enforcement action against an out-of-state fundraiser from Florida that was soliciting in Marion County and telling citizens here that the money raised was going to go back to the Marion County Sheriff's Office to buy bulletproof vests and other equipment for the sheriff's office. In fact, there was no connection at all. The sheriff's office had never been contacted. That's the kind of out-and-out misrepresentation that I'm talking about in that category. But lately, again, we've seen this more kind of subtle activity of fundraising scripts and spiels where there's just the hint and suggestion that the money is going to be used locally, coupled with the use of these private mailboxes. And this is becoming increasingly popular. We did a study in the last year and discovered that there were at least 20 such out-of-state solicitation campaigns that were using these private mailboxes in the state. We were also alerted to this problem by the state of New York that found the increasing use of this technique following 9/11.
And in fact, the state of New York has already adopted legislation similar to what we are proposing here. Section 2 is the substantive provision, and it essentially says if you don't have a bona fide office in the state, number one, and you use a local address for these return of contributions, then you must disclose two things. One, your actual headquarters of the charity, and that the local address is simply a mail handling facility. The second concept in the bill is embodied in Section 3, and that's what I refer to as the remedies. If professional fundraisers make misrepresentations about how the money is going to be used, we think that we have pretty ample tools in the law to deal with that. But the problem is that occasionally the representation that the professional fundraiser will make about the money going to the charity is accurate, but then the charity doesn't use the money for the actual program as represented and as it should be looking at it compared to its own charitable charter. Basically, what you have is gross mismanagement occurring by the officers and directors of the charity. If that were to occur in this state with an Oregon corporation, our remedies would be under the Oregon Nonprofit Corporation Act. We could seek to remove those directors. We could seek to have a receiver appointed. Ultimately, we could seek the dissolution of the organization and have the assets transferred to another bona fide charitable organization. But we don't have those remedies with out-of-state charitable organizations. We have to rely currently, to a great extent, on our counterparts in other states. And in some instances, they do a very good job, and in other instances, they don't have the resources or the legal authority to combat that kind of mismanagement. So what is then the solution? What we're proposing is that we think the solution is already embodied in a concept in the existing law. About a decade ago, we faced a more limited problem when we felt that charity managers were, if you will, giving away the farm and entering into certain contracts with professional fundraising firms. And so we, with the legislature's assistance, created certain requirements for those contracts, which are embodied in ORS 128.814. And then the legislature enacted a second provision which said that if you don't fulfill those duties, then the Oregon Attorney General can go to court and seek to enjoin solicitations in this state until the offenders are removed and the breach has been corrected. Section 3 of the bill proposes simply to delete the reference in line 24 of the existing language, that being the reference to ORS 128.814, so that remedy would now be available with any material breach of fiduciary duty by the officers and directors. So those are the two provisions in House Bill 2098. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ross. Let me ask you about, because that was the question that I had, is the one you just referenced, the elimination of the limitation of breaches of fiduciary duties as described in ORS 128.814. To give us a little bit of comfort, what's the process? Your office would go to the court seeking some sort of an injunctive relief. You would have to prove up to some standard to the court that there was a violation of breaches of fiduciary duty, which is now going to be a broader definition as a result of the elimination of that statutory reference. Is that right?
Chair Williams, yes, that is correct.
Okay.
I would also say that just for the committee's benefit, that, of course, the granting of an injunction is at the discretion of the court, and so we're going to have to meet some threshold that satisfies the judge that the traditional standards for equitable principles in terms of granting injunctions have been, that we've passed that bar.
Right, and the bar is, depending on the test, either a balancing test that the potential injury that could be done if you don't grant the injunction is greater than the injury that could potentially result if you have to wait to actually file the lawsuit and take it to trial, or the other one is your probability of success on the merits of your case that you'll be able to prove a breach of fiduciary duty. Is that
essentially right, if I got that about right?
Chair Williams, I believe so. And the other one is no other adequate remedy at law.
Right. In other words, if we don't stop them now, Your Honor, there won't be anything left by the time we get through the process.
Yes, and we have really no other remedy that we can...
There won't be any money left, therefore there won't be any ability under contract damages or anything else to be able to get to them. Okay. Any questions about this, Mr. Representative McPherson? I saw you reach for the purple book, so...
Yeah, I was... Mr. Chair, I was doing my research just as apropos of the question you were asking, but actually the question I wanted to ask of the witness Mr. Laybourne, is to get a fuller sense of what the scope of the problem is. As a person who is solicited as a member of the public for contributions, I have an impression that public safety-related causes tend to be the greatest area of activity. Is that a fair characterization, or are there other areas of activity that tend to be subject to this kind of the activity that this bill is directed at?
Chair Williams, Representative McPherson, I think that a lot of this has to do with telephone solicitations and bad solicitations for police and fire related groups. A lot of that tends to be done by telephone solicitation. Looking at my list that was compiled by my registrar, professional fundraisers, I mentioned about 20 organizations, professional fundraisers, who had used these in-state private mailboxes. I would say something on the order of 8 to 10 involve law enforcement or firefighting organizations. The other two popular ones are veterans organizations and those relating to children's causes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Are there any other questions about the bill?
I just have one question, Mr. Chair. Would this take care of organizations that call a person and say, gee, we'd like you to just mail out, 10 letters to 10 of your neighbors there on, and then they give your street name and ask them to send us money? Would this kind of eliminate that?
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, I don't believe so.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Maybe I'll wait if you're going to work there.
Okay, that would be fine. Mr. Laybourne, you were the only one who signed up to testify. Is there anyone else here in the room who's here to testify on House Bill 2098? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2098. Thank you, Mr. Laybourne, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2098. Representative Jensen, you want to move your mic over, too, so they can pick you up downstairs?
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very supportive of the idea and of what we're trying to do here. I'm having difficulty, however, conceptualizing how successful we're going to be at the process of this. My suspicion is, if these are further unscrupulous groups to begin with, that they're going to be bright enough to move in and out of states fast enough so that the actual tracking is going to be difficult to impossible, and therefore the enforcement of this statute be difficult. Having said that, I will support the bill, but I have a real reservation about how difficult it's going to be to enforce.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments, Representative Jensen. I too think that there will be a group of unscrupulous folks, the actual fraudulent solicitors, that will continue to, they'll print an Oregon address on the bill and do what they have to do and then leave town. I do think the helpful part of this is that it will allow those groups that are legitimately soliciting in a national sort of a way to at least identify themselves as being a national organization as opposed to having an Oregon operation. And I do think that that will give some people who have to make a decision with a limited amount of money they want to contribute for a charitable cause to say, do I want to do this at a national level, or am I more interested in keeping my dollars at home to Oregon charitable organizations? I agree it's a small step in an increasingly problematic area, but I appreciate your comments and your comments on the bill. Are there further comments on the bill? Hearing none, do I have a motion? Representative Jensen?
So moved.
Representative Jensen moves House Bill 2098 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, then, we will show the bill having passed unanimously with Representative Shetterly being excused.
I'll take it.
You want to take the bill? Then Representative Prozanski will be the carrier.
I'm going to give it a Shetterly since he's not here.
Yeah, that's fine. Representative Prozanski will carry House Bill 2098 to the floor. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2103. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2103 was introduced also at the request of the Attorney General for the Department of Justice. House Bill 2103 prohibits persons from selling, leasing, or renting any payment processing system that provides a receipt with more about information about customers than the last four digits of their credit or debit card numbers, and it also prohibits a person from creating such a receipt. House Bill 2103 further authorizes the Attorney General or the District Attorney to bring an action preventing a violation, creates civil penalties, allows the order of an injunction, and increases already existing penalties for unlawful credit or debit card solicitations. Finally, it authorizes the court to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party in any civil action. We do have some witnesses.
Okay, we'll start out with Ms. Pellegrini. You're here representing the Attorney General's office on the bill?
I am.
Yeah, please come forward. Thank you. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, and I'm the attorney in charge of the department's Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section. This bill did originate with my section. House Bill 21. I am here, obviously, to testify in support of House Bill 2103. The department considers this to be a crime prevention bill targeting the crime of identity theft. The written materials that are now being distributed to you contain some information that is drawn from a recent report by the Federal Trade Commission. Each year they publish a report of that reports on different types of crimes that they track through their national database, which is the Consumer Sentinel. Consumers self-report to that database. According to the FTC, identity theft is the number one reported crime in America today. It's a growing crisis in Oregon as well as the nation. In 2001, we were ranked number 7 in the nation on a per capita basis for incidents of identity theft, and that's incidents per 100,000 persons. In 2002, Oregon ranked 10th, but I think that if you look at the numbers, you'll note that it's not because there were fewer instances, it's just because the crime is being reported by more citizens across the nation. Identity theft is committed in a myriad of ways. One of the simplest ways is identity thieves use stolen credit cards and credit card numbers or other stolen personal information to either assume the victim's identity, run up charges on existing credit accounts, or use the victim's identity, open new credit accounts, open up accounts on the name of the victim, and run those up. One of the most popular techniques that law enforcement has found that criminals use to obtain the identities of victims is to go filtering through the dumpsters of retail merchants, department stores, and office buildings, and as well as the trash of all of us. And since we're a good recycling state,
We found that in an effort to promote recycling, we've also, I think, promoted a handy way for thieves to pick up personal information. Since 1999, identity theft has been classified as a B felony in Oregon. In cases where the thief has been caught, law enforcement has been very quick and effective in the prosecution of those thieves. As part of the state's identity theft working group, in order to address this problem under existing law, in addition to criminal prosecution, Attorney General Myers has worked with state and federal agencies, credit reporting agencies, financial institutions, and the private sector to try to come up with educational material that would benefit both consumers and businesses. And also out of that, this bill flowed not as a product of the committee's work, but as a product of the Attorney General's office. I mentioned criminal prosecution. While it's a felony offense in Oregon, law enforcement has found that it is an extremely difficult crime to prosecute, both for a couple of reasons. First, identity theft is a mobile crime. Once a thief obtains personal information, it's often bought and sold several times, and what may be stolen in Oregon can easily be used across the country by another thief. And it's not just used once. We've often found that once a person uses the identity of a person, they'll sell it again to someone else, and the pattern may repeat 2 to 3 times. Often, all of the criminals involved have profited and are long gone by the time the victim first finds out that their identity has been stolen. The FTC estimated recently that victims spend an average of $1,000 trying to undo the damage that's been wrought by identity thieves, and this includes working with credit reporting agencies, lenders, bank accounts, merchants whom they've dealt with. Prevention may be one of the most powerful tools we have to combat identity theft, and as I said at the beginning of my comments, House Bill 2103 is a prevention bill. What it would do is two things. First, it would require those who manufacture, distribute, or make available credit processing devices to stop putting into the stream of commerce devices that will record anything more than the last 4 digits of the consumer's account number on a receipt that's given back to the consumer. The second thing that House Bill 2103 does is that it provides merchants themselves, the users of credit processing devices, it gives them until January 1st of 2005 to stop using these devices and to start producing receipts that conform with the law. So there is a phase-in period. It is contemplated by the bill. House Bill 2103 further prohibits, or I would note that in addition to obliterating all but the last 4 numbers on a credit card receipt, it would also prohibit the recording of a consumer's name. And that was added in because it was the opinion of Attorney General Myers after looking at information made available through the Federal Trade Commission and other agencies that a receipt that contains only 4 digits and nothing more is virtually useless to thieves. And it was the best way that we could think of to protect consumers, at least in this arena. The bill also contains an enforcement mechanism which would allow the Attorney General to seek an injunction, or the Attorney General or a district attorney, to seek an injunction to prevent a merchant or retailer from violating the law and then to seek civil penalties against someone against whom an injunction has been obtained who continues to violate the provisions of the law. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Brzezinski.
I appreciate the clarification that you said as to where the Attorney General wants to go regarding the last 4 digits, because I was thinking that's all you're going to this bill provides for. So it's my understanding, first of all, what the Attorney General's position at this point is, the only identifier to a customer using a credit card on the receipt would be the last four digits of the credit card number.
Chair Williams, Representative Krasanski, that is correct.
And if I can follow up.
You can follow up.
Just for the record, want to make sure. So that means name, the expiration date of the card, the actual card, if it's Visa versus MasterCard, would not be on that receipt.
Chair Williams, Representative Krasanski, with the exception of the designation of a Visa or MasterCard, that's correct. I think that's correct. It's the last point, although...
So the card could still be identified on it with the last four digits, and then I would assume we're talking that since most of this is becoming so electronic, that the merchant would have the ability to retrace that transaction for some reason through the authorization number that's printed out on the card at this point. Is that correct?
Yes. Chair Williams, Representative Krasanski, I believe that Ms. Brandis and Mr. Oxley will testify next, might be able to tell you a little bit more about what the merchants record and retain, but I believe that's right. This bill is primarily targeted towards the piece of paper that is returned to the customer, that the customer then walks away from the transaction with.
Cheryl, question that I had just initially, and we'll give Julie and Gary a chance to speak on the bill as well. And I reached in my pocket and pulled out the receipt that I got last night when I had dinner at Applebee's on my way out of town with a couple of people. And as I'm looking at this receipt, it says it's a Visa. It says who at least the first name of the server that served me. It only shows the last four digits of my credit card number. It shows an approval code. It blacks out my expiration date and the balance of my stuff. But it has my name on it off of the card. And then it also has the place where I signed on the receipt, which is where I put my name on it, not coming out of their system. And so I always take a little bit of comfort when I get the thing back that it, even though it doesn't show my whole credit card, that it's shows my name, so I know that there's a relationship between this piece of paper, because I don't know the last four digits of my credit card number, and that tells me that they really got it on the right card and it's really me. And then I write my name on the bottom of the receipt, so at the end there is a receipt, even if they blocked it out, that technically would have my name on it as a result of me having to sign as the card member that I agree to pay all the charges. The name thing has me a little bit concerned, and I recognize that that's a valuable piece of data, but I just see this situation where you've got all these receipts lying around potentially on the counter at a restaurant, and nobody it just seems a lot harder to start linking them together. Have you guys thought much about the name issue beyond that?
Chair Williams, we have when we originally were looking at this bill in concept form, and I think that you'll probably hear from the industry that they share your concerns, perhaps for the same and perhaps for different reasons. What we did was we crafted the most protective bill that we could, understanding that we may then have to entertain, or we may be required to entertain, some amendments. This is one of them. And certainly we need to check with Attorney General Myers, but I believe that we'd be inclined to look at an amendment to include names if that was important to the committee and important to the industry.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and call up, and we may call you back up, Cheryl, to answer or respond to some of the comments. Julie Brandis from AOI and Gary Oxley representing some amalgamation of retailers, I suspect. Am I right about that, Gary?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Julie Brandis, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Retail Council. Just to be clear, the Oregon Retail Council comprises some of the nation's largest retailers that are in almost every single state. And as many of you know, they offer their own credit. They often have their own credit institutions internally. And the response I received from them today is, in respect to this bill, is that we are not opposed to the concept of the bill, but would like to have it more closely follow the statutes in other states, sort of the why reinvent the wheel, so that Oregon is different than maybe New Jersey is. The nation's retailers, and important to note, the nation's retailers are leaders in trying to prevent identity theft because we often pay the cost of the identity theft. So they sent to me this morning the New Jersey statute as an example, and they, one of the suggestion changes that they would ask for is that you have five numbers that appear on the receipt. And the reason why is, although unfortunately I was digging in my briefcase to see if I had some other store receipts, but stores, because they offer their own type of credit, often have more than four. It's just they're not in line with Visa or MasterCard or something, so they might have four numbers.
So you're, Mr. Chair, if I can.
Yes, Representative.
So you're saying five things. You're saying five digits?
Five digits, thank you. Pardon me. Five digits, that's correct. In Section 2, one of the questions, it's not of great concern to the retailers, but they suggested if it's against the law to utilize more than machines that utilize more than four or five digits, why would anyone manufacture such a device? There's, and what they suggested is that this action might not be necessary, but still, even if it is, there's not a lot of time to comply with this action, especially as it relates to leases and rental equipment. So you have a transition period where people are supposed, businesses are supposed to move to a machine that has the four digits or the five digits. And some, a smaller business especially might be leasing or renting a piece of equipment that is, like this one from a Salem restaurant that I took some legislators to dinner, and it's very old-fashioned. It has my name. It has the account number. This might be a leased machine, and until that company can purchase, the business can purchase a new machine, they might need some transition time.
And none of those legislators that you took to dinner are on this committee, are they?
Nope.
Okay, just checking.
Actually not.
And they're all wondering why you didn't invite us.
Darn.
Especially since we've got your bill here.
There, it's just the first couple weeks of session, you know. Section 3, a person may not create a, the language reads, a person may not create a receipt that does the following that shows more than the last four digits. That's we think that statute needs to be, that part of the statute might need to be clarified to say the customer, the receipt may not have more than four or five digits and maybe one other identification, as you suggested, Chair Williams. But the receipt that the retailer keeps certainly has to have more information on it. That is how we track the transaction. And so let's say the transaction doesn't go through. You run the credit card, it prints out, and you send the customer on the his or her way, and then all of a sudden something goes wrong or there's an error or the internet goes down, mm-hmm. We need to be able to type that information in again.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Pruszynski.
Have you checked with your industry? Because my understanding is that little authorization number or approval number is the way that you interface back on that transaction. You can actually call that number back.
Sure.
That complete transaction to rerun it through.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pruszynski, yes, I did check with our industry on it, and they do have authorization codes in most cases. But again, they're saying that it's still the only way we have to have additional information on a customer quickly is to have on our receipt something that is more descriptive than the last four digits. So here's the Cafe Today receipt from downstairs. you can see that I don't carry cash because I only had to buy something for $1. But the receipt that Cafe Today has does have more information on it. I believe the receipt that they have or the information that they are able to access would have more information than the last four digits of my number. So, for example, the copy of the signature. My signature isn't on this, but the Cafe Today has my signature because if all of a sudden I call and say, look, somebody's using my credit card, it's not me. One of the ways they verify that is by looking at the signature. So is that a clearer explanation of why we need more information?
Mr. Chair, if the witnesses could give us what type of information, because I'm very interested in this area. This is one area that I've been tracking as a prosecutor.
Yeah.
So we can make sure your interests can be covered.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, I think what I don't know all the information depending on all the financial institutions that might be here today.
Okay, our procedure, unfortunately, is to
Okay, we're going to go back on the record. Apologize for the inconvenience, but I'm sure everybody enjoyed the brisk walk and the fresh air. We're going to return to Ms. Brandis, who is in the middle of your comments on the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Julie Brandis with AOI and the Oregon Retail Council. When we had left due to the fire alarm, Representative Prozanski asked that we compile a list of what it is that retailers might need on the credit the slips, and we certainly agree to sit down and make sure that information becomes clearer and to work again, because we are not opposed to the concept of the bill, just the, currently the details of the bill. And in closing, I would just ask you to take a look at the timeline of the bill going into effect. It is slightly compressed to what most states have done. If you imagine that the bill actually goes into effect on January 1, 2004, the retailer would have a year to comply, which isn't very hard, I think, for the large retailers. It might be hard for the smaller retailers and maybe some of the restaurants. And the manufacturing timeline might be a little compressed. Most states have given 3 years from the date of the date the law goes into effect to full implementation. I think because we're one of many states that is working toward this, it might not be hard for the larger retailers, but again, the smaller retailers might be impacted. That concludes my remarks. I'm very happy and willing to work on this legislation to get it into an acceptable form. Identity theft is a growing problem, and we're certainly willing to work on anything to prevent it.
Thank you, Julie. Gary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon representing Fred Meyer, Safeway, and Rite Aid. Likewise, my clients support the concept, understand the need to have legislation of this nature, and are very concerned likewise about protecting the interests of the consumer. One of the issues that we would like to address, however, is the signature, is the name issue on the receipt. My retailers in particular have invested heavily into the club card or loyalty card concept, and I'm sure most of you sitting here in the hearing this afternoon probably have a loyalty card or a club card from some particular retail entity that you do business with. I have three examples here from Safeway of the use of either a credit card, and a club card, or cash and a club card. And unlike my counterpart, I did not take any legislators to dinner at Safeway. But as you will note, though, the name of the individual appears on all three of these, and one of the reasons for this is the marketing concept in and of itself. Surveys have shown continually that consumers like acknowledgement and like to be recognized at the end of a transaction or during a sale. So in Safeway's case particularly, when they hand the receipt to the customer, the clerk looks at it, verifies it, and then thanks the customer by name for trading in the store. Fred Meyer, Rite Aid, likewise have the name of the client, the participant, customer on the receipt, and we have addressed this issue with the AG's office, and they seem willing to want to work with us on that concept. I also addressed this very issue with Bill Perry of the Oregon Restaurant Association. Likewise, they have concerns with the name not being on the receipt, and Bill made a very interesting observation that it's many times the invoice and card are returned to the table by the waiter, and they may have made a mistake. And where you pick up on that is you go down to the signature line to sign your name, and suddenly you realize it's not yours. Now, some people might sign and leave if the bill's lower than their bill would have been. But other than that, this is a good catch-all for the consumer and for the restaurant itself. So with notwithstanding other issues that Julie raised, we do support the concept, but would very much like to see the name remain as part of the receipt. We believe that's very integral to the process.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. I'd encourage you to continue to work with Ms. Pellegrini and the folks at the AG's office, and also respond to Representative Prozanski's request for the additional information. And to the extent that you think it would be worthwhile for us to maybe see a comparison to the proposal as compared to maybe New Jersey and several other states that have already acted on this, on the key components of the bill, that might be a helpful thing for the committee to consider the next time the bill is scheduled. So thank you both. Are there questions for either of them?
Mr. Chair,
Go ahead.
Encourage you to call me with that information, and I can arrange to have
another hearing scheduled, and if there are amendments, can arrange to have that done as well.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there any provisions for the merchant or the retailer as far as destruction of those receipts? Where do those go? Are they shredded? Do they? Is there no standardization as how people?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, are you asking about the receipts that we keep for our records?
Right.
I do not know if there's a standard legal requirement. And for some, I think for some industries there would be for any financial transaction that occurs right. under a federal law. But I would assume that, like most financial documents, our companies shred them.
Shred them, yeah.
Anything further? Thank you both. Steve Dixon from Osprey. Hi, Steve. Please begin.
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of committee, my name is Steve Dixon. I'm the consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit public interest research and advocacy organization with 25,000 members throughout the state of Oregon. And I'm happy to be here today in support of House Bill 2103, which, as we all know, would essentially require all but the final four digits of credit and debit card receipts to be eliminated. OSPIRG supports this bill because we believe that it is an important step in curtailing the rate of identity theft. Access to credit and debit card numbers on receipts is one of the easiest ways that identity thieves can gain access to Oregonians' bank and credit accounts. As we've heard today, the trends for identity theft are alarming. The Federal Trade Commission has reported that reported instances of identity theft have doubled in 2002 to 380,000 nationally, and it is the fastest growing crime, and it has topped the government's list of consumer frauds for three consecutive years. The actual instances nationally are likely to be much higher, as many of these cases of identity theft go undiscovered or unreported. The U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 700,000 people may actually fall victim to identity theft. And the Oregon stats are sobering. According to our data, Oregon ranks sixth in states in identity theft in 2001, or as the department, Cheryl has stated, we're actually seventh, but that's if you included the District of Columbia, which is also included in the FTC reports. 36.7 Oregonians per 100,000 reported being victimized by identity theft in 2001. I did not have the newer numbers that Cheryl has, so this is what is still up on the FTC's website and is current. And 30% of, well, it's current on the FTC's website. 30% of those identity thefts that occurred were through access of existing accounts. Of course, there are many ways that people can access an existing account, but again, this is one of the simplest ways. Because unlike other forms of identity theft, which require social security numbers and some sort of other information to, say, fill out a false application for a loan, all you need to do is have the receipt with the number printed out in full, and you can then begin to go onto the internet and purchase plane tickets or whatnot, and empty consumers' credit or bank accounts. The combo of mishandling by some businesses, I know a lot of businesses have gone to great lengths to protect consumer privacy, but a lot of businesses have mishandled consumers' personal and private information, and inadequate state and federal protections, as well as illegal acts by identity thieves, leave Oregonians vulnerable. The cost to consumers is great. In 1998, OSPIRG released a report called Nowhere to Turn, Victims Speak Out on Identity Theft, where we had found that once personal private information gets into the hands of identity thieves, information like social security numbers, financial and non-financial information, internet accounts, and credit and debit card numbers, consumers can expect to spend up to $800 and 175 hours clearing their name from each instance of identity theft. And the Department of Justice actually estimates that the financial cost is much higher at $1,000 on average. Some of the costs to consumers are the denial of legitimate credit, insurance accounts, mortgages, and bank accounts. And there's also the psychological impact from identity theft that we should also consider, which is frustration, feelings of violation, insecurity and mistrust of government and businesses that consumers rely on to protect them and treat them fairly. And that has a broad sort of societal cost. The generally technological advances are beneficial. However, there are accompanying costs, and one of those is identity theft. Information and opportunities for identity thieves are widely available as technological advances outpace government's actions to deal with the resulting problems. Along with some businesses, and again, I want to state that some businesses, not all, many do, go to great lengths to protect consumer privacy, but some businesses do mishandle or buy, sell, and trade consumers' personal and private information without their knowledge or consent. I think the current trends in identity theft are staggering and really serve as stark evidence that current protections for Oregon consumers are unreasonably weak and more needs to be done. And we think that House Bill 2103 is a step in the right direction and will eliminate the most absurdly easy way that identity thieves can get a hold of consumers' information. So we urge you to support 2103 and refer it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And moreover, I would request that this committee and the Oregon legislature as a whole look into or investigate and address the growing threats to consumer privacy that we're seeing. With that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any sort of questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Dixon. Are there questions for Mr. Dixon from the committee? Okay. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. All right. We are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2103. Colleagues, if you could stick with us for a couple of minutes, I want to get a sense. I have two witnesses signed up on House Bill 2426. Mr. Gardner and Mr. Gallagher, is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2426? How long do you gentlemen believe you're going to take?
3 seconds.
Okay, then we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2426. Please proceed. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. You have my written testimony. My name is Jim Gardner from the law firm Gardner & Gardner, and I appear before you today representing the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Pharma's membership consists of the major research-based pharmaceutical manufacturers which discover, manufacture, and market prescription drugs. House Bill 2426 is a very simple bill that does one thing. It makes technical and advisory committees that advise the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research subject to the Oregon Public Meetings Law. This is a sibling of a bill that you passed last session, House Bill 2945, which is attached, which went through this committee, and which some of you veterans may recall. I mention this because our experience in the aftermath of the passage of House Bill 2945 indicates why it would be good public policy to pass House Bill 2426. Last session, we were trying to open up to public scrutiny one particular OMAP advisory committee that had been meeting behind closed doors and engaging in discussions that we felt raised serious state and federal antitrust concerns. We wanted to let the sun shine in on these meetings so that the public members of the press and representatives of our industry, among others, could be kept informed of this particular advisory committee's deliberations. After the law took effect, and much to our surprise, we learned that there were numerous OMAP advisory committees dealing with extremely important topics that we, and I dare say most members of the public and the healthcare industry, other than the attendees of these particular committees, did not even know existed. Turning to the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, which is the subject of this bill, there are a number of advisory committees established pursuant to the mandate of last session Senate Bill 819, which created the Practitioner-Managed Prescription Drug Plan for the Oregon Health Plan. We have significant concerns regarding the consistency with which timely information is shared concerning the meetings as well as the agendas of those committees. Often a meeting is announced with no specific agenda, and because of the very technical nature of the issues being considered and the fact that those best equipped to provide relevant information reside in many instances outside the state, the reasonable notice provisions of the public meetings laws make sense. In addition, what we cannot know absent passage of House Bill 2426 is whether there are other OHPR advisory committees, formal or informal, intrastate or multistate, focused on prescription drug issues or focused on entirely different issues that have been meeting behind closed doors without the public's knowledge. Our experience in the aftermath of the passage of House Bill 2945 last session has induced a certain level of concern that this might have occurred or might be occurring, at least on an episodic basis. Passage of House Bill 2426 would have the salutary effect of making all such OHPR advisory committees subject to the Oregon public meetings laws. This would not only open up such meetings to the public, but also ensure compliance with ORS 192.640, which requires public notice, quote, reasonably calculated to give actual notice to interested persons, including news media, which have requested notice of the time and place for holding regular meetings, as well as notice of the principal subjects anticipated to be covered at the meeting. And as I mentioned before, in the past, certain OHPR advisory committee meetings, while held publicly, have not been preceded by such notice, at least in our view. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Why don't we have Mr. Gallagher's comments, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers, and we support open records and open meetings and follow these things very closely. I'll make two quick points here. In Section 8 of the bill, 2426, you see that what is being changed here are not the sections of the public meetings law, but it's being attached to the Oregon Health Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. So it's subjecting the advisory committees of this body to those provisions of the open meetings law. The reason I point that out is because there are literally thousands of advisory committees attached to state government, local bodies, etc. And it seems like the key to when those are subject to public records laws to whether or not they have the ability to impact decision making or have decision makers involved in those meetings. It's almost impossible to tell in many cases when these meetings have a tremendous impact or are the de facto decision that is then moved on and made at some other point. We're interested in watching this, seeing how this particular section works. I don't think it'd be advisable to open every advisory committee, subject them all to the same kind of scrutiny, considering how many they are, how burdensome it would be. But this is an interesting approach to take some of the more important and the more technical ones, which are watched by closely by specific industries, and make them subject to the same set of open records and open information that public bodies have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Are there questions for either of the witnesses? Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill? Last session we had somebody from the department who at least was willing to come in and talk about it. Do you remember that, Bob?
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In fact, I think a key aspect of how we might act on this bill would depend upon how it fits into the operation of the affected agency, and so I would be reluctant to act without at least having some sense about either approval, disapproval, or ambivalence.
Yeah, I understand your concern, Representative McPherson. I will say that it was an interesting dialogue in the last session as this bill came forward, and there was some fairly substantive testimony. And the meetings that they were most concerned about is meetings where you had groups that are normally prohibited from getting together and talking about price setting, getting together and potentially talking about price setting with respect to prescription drugs and the like. And it raised some issues about, at least in my mind, and I think in the minds of some other folks, about the potential violation of antitrust law that might be going on in these meetings behind closed doors. And so I am a bit surprised, having had this posted, to see no one. Is there anyone from the department in the room that wants to admit who they are and raise their hands? Okay. Well, yes, Representative Anderson.
This would probably be more for the work session, but responding to your complaint, having been restricted as a mayor to doing everything within the open meetings law, I don't see how any board or agency could really operate that way legally, or as it seems to be. I appreciate it. It'd be nice to hear from them. But,
and I think that's the part that would be beneficial to the committee, and because these advisory committees are often made up of contract providers to the state, so they're not the participants in these meetings are not necessarily public employees or public agencies, but they are agencies or entities that are working under a contract relationship with the state. But to the extent that there are decisions being made which are recommendations for critical policy decisions for the OMAP folks, the issue of access and openness in those meetings is rather critical. And so that's the issue. I guess I will, now that we've sort of laid it on the table, and I recognize Representative McPherson's reluctance without hearing something more, and I know that I'm looking around, and other than Representative Ackerman, I don't think anybody else on the committee dealt with this issue in the last legislative session. So to allow the rest of you to catch up and to give the agency or the OMAP folks an opportunity if they want to come in and say anything about this, I'm not going to move this bill into work session today, but I'm going to ask that it get reset for sometime next week on the agenda. So if, between now and next week, if you want to find out more about this and no one's coming to talk to you, make some phone calls, because we are going to move this bill into work session in about a week or so, and that will be the opportunity we have to have gotten some feedback. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2426.